planet. It's quite possible, as T.S. Eliot has said, that the end of all our exploring will be to arrive where we started and know the place for the first time. Until next time, this is Kim Weir for Up the Road.
This is FM 90.1 KZFR Chico, listener-supported community radio for the Sacramento Valley, the foothills, and beyond. You can also contact us at kzfr.org, where we stream live.
You're playing. This is Ecotopia on KZFR 90.1 in Chico. And tonight our guest will be Tierra Curry. She is a senior scientist at the Center for Biological Diversity, where she leads the Saving Life on Earth campaign to end extinction.
Having a little trouble getting some music on here, folks. Our usual problems on a Tuesday night. We'll be with you in a little bit.
This is Ecotopia on KZFR 90.1 in Chico. And with us on the phone now is Tiara Curry. As I mentioned, she's a senior scientist at the Center for Biological Diversity, where she leads the Saving Life on Earth campaign to end extinction. Welcome, Tiara. It's so good to have you here.
It's so good to be here, Susan. Thank you.
So we want to know, actually, we have worked a bit in Chico with the Center for Biological Diversity, but I'm not sure that people know a lot about it, even though it's pretty enormous. Could you tell us what the Center for Biological Diversity is?
Sure, and I would love to know more about what we were involved with together in Chico. The Center is a nonprofit organization that is focused on saving endangered species and preventing extinction. And so we work on all species from fairy shrimp all the way up to whales, because we think that life on Earth is dependent on all of the other species that we share the planet with. So we want to make sure that they stick around.
So what's the structure? When I was looking for someone to talk to about endangered species, I went to your website and looked at the staff and the expertise of the various staff members. It's enormous.
I wouldn't say it's enormous. I've been here for 15 years now, and when I started, there were about 40 of us. Now there's about 200 of us, which is great, but really the extinction crisis and the climate crisis are so dire at this point that it would be great if there could be millions of us, because we all just work as hard as we can, but there's projects that we can't pick up. So we are structured in different programs, from endangered species to public lands to environmental health, energy justice, oceans, urban wildlands. Basically everywhere where there's a species that needs to be saved, we do our best to jump in and make a difference. So we work across the country and also in Mexico.
Oh, in Mexico too. I did not know that. Can you give some examples of the kinds of projects that it does? How do you work on, or how do different people in these various areas work on creating and maintaining and working for biological diversity?
So we use policies, but also activism and something we call creative media, and a lot of outreach as well. So where we can, we try to gain protection for imperiled species under the Endangered Species Act, and then make sure that those protections are actually being enforced, and that the species that are listed as endangered or threatened also get critical habitat and a recovery plan. We also work on climate policy. We work on wildlife trade. We have an international program that is trying to ban trophy imports from Africa and to enforce wildlife trade standards so that we don't get into another pandemic situation. In my role, I do a lot of outreach about the extinction crisis. So I talk to students from kindergarteners through grad school and to community groups, and I go to international conferences and just do everything I can to raise awareness about what's happening, but also to inspire people to get involved so that they don't just feel overwhelmed and that they feel empowered to make a difference.
Right, right. How did you become involved with, you've been there for a long time, how did you initially become involved in the Center for Biological Diversity?
So I grew up in eastern Kentucky in Appalachia, where it is so beautiful and there's so many species, but also where the coal industry literally just blows up mountains, fills in streams, and gets by with it. And so from early on, I had this sense of injustice and that they didn't have the right to blow up the mountain. And so I wanted to grow up and do something about that, and I decided to focus on extinction. And one day, in my environmental science class, actually in Alaska, one of my professors was talking about the Southwest Center for Biological Diversity, as it was known at the time, and they had filed a lawsuit to try to protect cactus ferruginous pygmy owls from urban sprawl. I knew that I wanted to work for this organization. It was going to bat for this obscure little creature. So basically, I saw a biologist position post and wrote them a letter saying, please pick me because this is my dream job. And luckily they did. And 15 years later, I'm still at it.
So when you first were concerned about extinction, and it sounds like you were a kid when you started worrying about extinction, were there particular creatures that you looked to or particular things that you were especially worried about?
So I grew up on a creek, and my earliest memories are of hearing frogs that were so loud. You could hear them indoors. You could hear them over music. Just the soundtrack of my childhood is frogs, spring peepers in particular. So when I was in college, that's when the amphibian extinction crisis really started getting awareness in the 1990s. There were all of these stories about frog deformities, and like the hole in the ozone was a big story at the time, and everybody was trying to figure out what was happening with the frogs. And so that's the species that I became most passionate about. But then I joined the center and I learned that mollusks, that freshwater mussels and snails, are even more endangered. And then over the years, I've just worked on hundreds and hundreds of different species, because all of them have a story to tell about the place where they are and the community that lives there, but also what we're doing to the planet.
We hear a lot about the global extinction crisis. The sixth extinction, extinction, is that the title of that book? By
Elizabeth Colbert.
I mean, it's a huge topic of conversation, but somehow people don't seem to take it seriously, or they don't know how bad it is. So how bad is it?
It's really bad. And I think one of the things, humans, we tend to be, even though we focus on bad news, we tend to be optimistic. So it's hard to wrap our heads around the fact that nature is really on the line around the entire planet. A couple of years ago, a study came out from the United Nations that said that 1 million species are now at risk of extinction.
Wow.
And that could be even more species depending on the decisions that we make about climate. If we don't keep climate change below 1.5 degrees Celsius, then 1 in 3 species is at risk of extinction. And before a species goes extinct, wildlife populations crash. And so a study, the Living Planet Index by the Worldwide Fund for Nature, found that on average, 70% of wildlife populations have been in decline around the globe. So these are vertebrate populations that we have actual data for. And then another index is the International Union for Conservation of Nature. That's an umbrella group of different organizations. The center is one of the organizations in that group. They're trying to collect the data for every species on the planet.
And so gosh.
Yeah, it's a big job. So far, they've only been able to assess around 140,000 species. But of those, they found that around 1 in 4 species is at risk of extinction. So the UN took that 1 in 4 number, looked at how many species are on the planet, and that's how they came up with 1 million species are now at risk.
Wow. And so things, just because they're at risk doesn't mean that they get on the endangered species list. That's a whole different process, right?
Yes, it is a very different process. Unfortunately, it would be wonderful if the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and the Fisheries Service took all of the imperiled species and protected them, but unfortunately, it doesn't work like that. There are a couple different routes to gaining protection under the Endangered Species Act. One is the Fish and Wildlife Service can just add species to the list. They hardly ever do this.
The other route
is that individuals and groups can file a formal scientific and legal petition asking the agency to protect the species. And so that starts this whole process. The agency is supposed to issue a 90-day finding on whether or not the petition presents enough information that the decision may be warranted. Then they, if they say that the action may be warranted, then they gather the, all the information that they can about the species. And they're supposed to issue a decision within a year. So species following a petition should be listed within 2 years. But unfortunately, because of political interference and because of a backlog and lack of funding, and because as a country we're not taking the extinction crisis seriously, it can take around 10 to 12 years
for
species to get listed. So it's very frustrating. We're behind the curve. And one really disappointing thing that just happened, there was this proposed legislation called Recovering America's Wildlife Act. It was popular, it had bipartisan support, and it would have provided funding to recover endangered species and to states and tribes to recover species before they're even listed, so to assess all of the unpopular species that we don't pay all that much attention to, like crayfishes and bees and snails and beetles. It would have provided much needed funding for the United States to assess the state of wildlife and to recover the ones that were imperiled, but it did not pass. And that is just so frustrating because so many people supported it on both sides of the aisle. And it's, I mean, it's just another indicator that we're not taking it seriously.
Yeah, we're not taking it seriously. Do you do any sort of work across countries? You talked about Mexico, but do you have any sense, or do people try to from other countries use the model that you've set up or use the processes that you've set up to learn about endangered species? Because it seems like the United States is really slacking on this, but I think about Africa and what you said about trophy species. And so I'm wondering if what you know, if anything, about what's going on in other countries.
So in December, I was in Montreal for the 15th Conference of the Parties of the Convention on Biological Diversity. This is a global treaty from 1992 that every country on Earth is party to, except for the United States and the Vatican.
Oh my gosh.
And, right? So every 10 years, they meet to set out a global biodiversity framework for the decade. So the conference was supposed to be in 2020, but because of the pandemic, it just happened in December 2022. And the framework that was negotiated will be the biodiversity strategy for the nearly 200 countries that are party to it. And one of the most important things that came out of that meeting was a commitment to protect 30% of Earth's lands and waters for wildlife and for the protection of nature. There were no details hashed out about what will qualify as protected, and there certainly isn't enough funding from the global north to the global south, but that's the goal that was set by all of these countries. And the convention also addressed things like pesticides and plastic pollution and subsidies. There's a commitment to try to cut the harmful subsidies that are driving biodiversity loss and climate change. The other really good thing that came out of it was a commitment to protect the rights of indigenous peoples. So not to use a colonial fortress model of conservation where people are kicked off their land in the name of conservation, but to work with the indigenous peoples, respect and safeguard their rights, and help them protect their livelihoods and also the biodiversity that their territories harbor.
So it sounds like there are concerned people. Are you seeing, I guess I'd like to ask, what sort of successes you've seen in protecting various species, either through the Center for Biological Diversity or as you've been to conferences and talked with other people who are working on specific things, or, you know, among your colleagues? Do you guys have conventions where you say, okay, here's where it's working?
Yes. So one of the things that happens after a species finally gets listed under the Endangered Species Act, I'm so sorry.
Hi!
So once a species is rigged, is protected, I don't know, even though Hawaii's barking at him, I'm in Kentucky and it's completely dark here. They get critical habitat and a recovery plan. And then they get protection from take, so it becomes illegal to harm them or their habitat. And there's also a requirement that federal agencies consult with the Fish and Wildlife Service on federally permitted or funded projects to make sure that their activities aren't jeopardizing the species or adversely modifying its critical habitat. So the Endangered Species Act is the strongest law for nature protection anywhere on the planet. But it takes a while for species to get that protection.
Right.
And so this year is the 50th anniversary of the ESA, and we've seen more than 50 species recovered under the act. So across the country, there's success stories from the snail darter to brown pelicans, bald eagles, gray whales, endemic species that only live in small areas. Several species in California were proposed for delisting recently, especially on the Channel Islands, as they've addressed threats to foxes and vegetation there. Lots of species are beginning to recover, but recovery takes time, and the further that populations have declined before they get listed, the harder recovery is.
So what is the job of people on the ground who are helping to recover? How do they go about doing that? Take an example of like a fox or the pelican or...
Every species faces sort of a unique suite of threats. For the pelicans and also bald eagles, DDT, the pesticide,
right,
was causing their eggshells to be too thin, and so they couldn't successfully reproduce. And because of protection, the development and the release of that pesticide into the environment was curtailed. For other species, especially on the Channel Islands, after invasive farm animals were introduced there, invasive pigs and other things that harm the native vegetation, once they realized that so many species were dependent on the native vegetation, they took steps to remove the invasive animals. The vegetation recovered, and that helped the wildlife recover.
Oh, wow. I just heard a report this morning on, I think it must have been on NPR, about reintroducing bison into prairies that have been mainly grazed by cattle. And the description of the recovery of the land, in addition to the thriving of the bison, was really stunning, because the bison, they described, if you looked on one side, there was a grassy meadow. It was like a monoculture. And if you looked on the other side where the bison were, it was really diverse vegetation, and it's because there are some things the bison eat and some things they don't eat, and so it's much more diverse because they are native and they're taking care of or operating with, you know, in congruence with nature, I guess. So that really makes sense to me. If you get rid of the invasive stuff that's creating the problem, then you can begin to solve the problem.
Especially like some species of butterflies only lay their eggs on one host plant. If you have an invasive plant that's wiping out their native plant, they just don't have a chance. And so managers can go in, volunteers can help remove the non-native vegetation and replant the native vegetation. And it's interesting that you bring up the bison in Kentucky. We have this endangered species called running buffalo clover, and its habitat is areas where wild bison used to wallow and create these indentations in the ground. And so that's where the running buffalo clover survives. But now it has to be actively managed to keep the invasive vegetation out. And and cows don't play the same role in the ecosystem.
So in your 15 years, what have been your favorite things to work on, and what have been your greatest disappointments, and what have been your biggest successes?
So I do a lot of work on endangered freshwater mussels. Mm-hmm. They're not charismatic. A lot of people don't think that they're very beautiful. They don't even have a face to be another pretty face, but they're very interesting and unique, and they play such an important role in rivers because they filter water, they stabilize the stream bottom, they provide housing for other animals, they have these intricate relationships with the fish. But I really enjoy working on them just because not a lot of people know about them. The most popular species that I work on is the monarch butterfly. Mm-hmm. And that one has been, it's such a challenge. When I first started looking into it, I literally said, there's no way monarchs are endangered. Monarchs are everywhere. They're in 48 states. But then as I researched their situation, they're so vulnerable at specific points in their life cycle. So the monarchs east of the Rocky Mountains overwinter in the mountains of Mexico, and the monarchs west of the Rocky Mountains overwinter on the coast of California. Huh. And in their overwintering habitat, they're all clustered, and they're very vulnerable to winter storms, to development. In California in particular, their overwintering habitats, a lot of them aren't protected, and so developers can still cut down trees even if they're known to be important for monarch butterflies. But then in the spring, that winter generation has to lay the eggs for the next generation. So they have to find milkweed plants, and they have to find milkweed plants that haven't been contaminated with pesticides. Uh-huh. And they have to fly across so many roads and buildings to complete their journey. So there used to be billions of them. Now the population has been reduced by 80 to 90%.
Wow.
And they're just such a beautiful species. They're so important culturally in the United States and Canada and Mexico. So the story of their migration really unites the entire continent and tells the story of landscape level changes that we've made to grasslands, prairies, forests. But they're a species that is so popular that they're like a gateway bug to get people interested in the decline of other insects. And everybody can help them by planting milkweed and by choosing organic produce and by fighting for getting involved in local zoning battles to protect the green space and try to curb sprawl and never-ending development. So that species it's dear to my heart now because it's a species that everybody can relate to and that everybody can help.
So are things improving for monarchs, or are they still struggling to maintain?
They're still very vulnerable. The good news in California is this year there are around, the final count isn't out yet, but there are around 300,000 overwintering monarchs. And that is an amazing comeback. A couple of years ago, the winter population in California was down to 2,000 butterflies.
Oh, my gosh.
And we were all just devastated and biting our fingernails and wondering if they would be able to bounce back. And they have. And now there's 300,000 of them. But they remain unprotected and completely vulnerable to impacts from neonicotinoid insecticides, mm-hmm. from herbicides like Roundup and just from urban sprawl.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we're fighting a big urban sprawl project here in Chico. In fact, I'm going from here to speak to the among a whole bunch of other people, I hope, to speak to this city council about this urban sprawl project, because we have endangered meadow foam. And one of the problems that I found in doing this kind of work is that people go, well, what's one flower more or less, or what's one bug more or less? And so they don't have any clue about how everything is interrelated, how everything is dependent on something else that's dependent on something else, that the whole system has to work together. So a lot of your work must be educational work.
Oh, for sure. And the other thing, all the species in their ecosystem are connected. Humans are entirely dependent on the health of the ecosystem.
Yes.
For things like pollination, water filtration, flood control. The sprawl battle isn't just happening there or here. It's happening everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's so important for people to get involved in those local battles, because something like 30% of all developed land has been developed in the last 40 years.
Oh my gosh.
Acres of habitat every single day. Forests, wetlands, grasslands. It's just ongoing.
But
so it's very important that we protect what's left.
So would you say that statistic again? 30% of all
the development
has happened
in the United States has been developed in the last 40 years.
Wow. I'll take that to my meeting tonight. So how does your education work?
Well, I'll tell you a funny story. I started giving talks about extinction, and some of the first ones that I gave, I put up photos of the species that have recently become extinct, and I told their stories and the stories of the places, and people were so depressed. People were like walking out of the talk because they were so depressed.
Yeah.
And I realized it can't stop there. I can't just present all of this information about how bad things are. I have to convince people that they can make a difference, that action is the antidote to despair. And there are so many ways for people to get involved, from supporting conservation organizations to using apps like iNaturalist and Seek to monitor the birds and the plants that they encounter so that we have that information, to going to city council meetings like you're getting ready to do to speak up for local areas. People can get involved in the fight against climate change at a personal level by eating less meat and reducing their carbon footprint, but also just by talking to other people, because a lot of people aren't even aware that we're in an extinction crisis, mm-hmm. or that there's anything that they can do about it. So we still just have a lot of basic education and inspiration to get out there so that more people do care, because I think people do care. I think people love nature and animals and birds. A lot of studies came out in the pandemic showing that access to nature and interacting with nature is really good for mental health and also for educational outcomes.
I asked you in our emails before this if you knew anything about loss of wetlands in California, and you said you're not an expert on California, but you do know something about how the loss of wetlands affects. California has lost 90% of its wetlands. And so why is that so awful?
Yeah, across the country, we've lost 85% of our wetlands.
Wow.
And so this has big problems for biodiversity, because wetlands harbor so many different kinds of life, but also for the water cycle, for water purification and flood control, especially as we move into an era of climate chaos and more and severe storms. Healthy wetlands help prevent those storms. Wetlands provide all kinds of ecosystem services for us, and also in terms of carbon storage and sequestration. They're one of the environments that can help stabilize the climate. So if we restored wetlands and stopped destroying them, it would protect species, but it would also help in the battle against climate change.
The other thing that we talked about before you came on the air was some other specific species, and I wonder if you could talk about other species and what their status is. You talked about the Humboldt martens.
Yes, the Humboldt marten is hands down the cutest animal that I've ever worked on. They were thought to be extinct, and then they were rediscovered on a remote sensing camera in the redwoods.
But what do they look like? Describe a Humboldt marten.
They are adorable. They kind of are shaped like a cat with a big fluffy tail and a triangular face. they're mustelids, so they're related to weasels and otters, and they are always hungry. They have to eat like a third of their body weight every day. They eat everything from berries and insects to honey and birds, but they also have to not get eaten. So bobcats, raptors, lots of things are out to eat them, so they're very secretive. They do not like crossing open environments. They really prefer old growth forests and closed canopy environments where they can hunt without being seen. So they've declined to only 4 populations. There's less than 400 of them. They live in Northern California and Southern Oregon, and these populations are isolated from each other because of clear cuts. So a lot of species, their decline is complicated, but Humboldt martins, it's because of logging. So if we restored those forests and reconnected them, we could help save them. So I petitioned for their protection back in like 2009. They finally got protected a couple of years ago, and now we're fighting individual projects that want to continue logging their habitat.
And how's that going? Are there commitments, or do people see the value of doing that? I remember how people ridiculed the efforts to save the spotted owl. You know, it's just an owl. Why do we have to stop all of our commerce for an owl?
Right, and with the spotted owl, one of the things that it got was buffers. So, like on the coast of Oregon, especially on state lands, you can hike up to a high point and look down at the circles that are the buffers around nests, and they're not connected. Luckily, the owls can fly, but the Humboldt martin has to have connected forests. Because when they try to cross an opening, they get eaten, and they don't want to cross it. And so those fights are ongoing, because you would think that since we've already lost 95% of old-growth forests on the West Coast, that everyone would agree we should save what's left. But unfortunately, that's not the case. Another California species that I've worked on that is worth mentioning is Lasix lupins. This beautiful pink wildflower, it only grows in alpine habitat, and the areas where it grows are protected, but it's threatened because of climate change. The summer heat has become so severe that it's stressed the animals and its environment and the other vegetation, and so predation on its seeds has increased so much that scientists have to go in and cage off the individual plants so that they can reproduce. This species is significant because it grows in protected areas, but climate change still threatens its existence. And that's like the statistic that I shared, that if we don't keep warming below 1.5 degrees, we could lose 1 in 3 species by the end of the century. And this is one of them. But it is now protected. It's got protection under the Federal Endangered Species Act and the California Endangered Species Act, which means that there'll be ongoing efforts to protect it and cage it off, and it'll get funding and monitoring. So it's a success story in that way, and that it did get the help that it needs, but it's a cautionary tale for life on Earth.
I'm curious about what you think about environmental impact reviews. On the one hand, I see them, and of course lots of others see them, as really significant for addressing the kinds of things that you're talking about, that we need to make sure that, that like in this urban sprawl project, they say, well, we're going to have a lot of open space, and we're going to make sure that we don't go in when this bird is nesting, or we're not going to disturb the habitat of this bird. But there are several birds there that really depend on that area. And I'm skeptical that, number one, that the mitigations can possibly be done, and number two, that just the process of even going in there is going to disrupt the habitat. And there have been, it seems to me, on the side of commerce, more, letting people fast-track development projects because we need them. So I wonder what, if you have any experience in this area and how you've seen that work or not work.
So at the federal level, under the National Environmental Policy Act, agencies are required to produce an environmental impact statement or an environmental assessment to review all the proposed project and its purpose and need, but also the potential alternatives to the project. And part of that is sort of the baseline that you were talking about. And if agencies do a good job, then this process takes a long time, and you really get a sense of what would happen if it happened. But like you said, a lot of times projects just get fast-tracked now at the federal level. They get fast-tracked under a finding of no significant impact, which is really right. just a rubber stamp.
Right.
At the local level, California is at way ahead of the curve. Under California laws, there are environmental reviews, but in the rest of the country, in a lot of places, that doesn't even happen.
Oh, my gosh.
And, yeah.
I'm kind of obsessed on our project right now, but even though they found two impacts that cannot be mitigated for this project, the city has prepared a statement of overriding considerations, which means they say these things are more important than these environmental problems that can't be mitigated. And so I've become a little cynical about environmental reviews.
Well, and one of the things that they never look at enough are the cumulative impacts.
Yes.
So if they're just myopically looking at that project, they're not looking at the greater landscape of all of the projects. They might not be adequately considering the climate change impacts of a particular project, especially in relation to all of the other projects that are going on. So it's always worth it to push back and to bring up every single potential issue. Because
right.
California laws are some of the strongest laws in the nation in terms of being forced to consider climate impact and cumulative impact.
We're running out of time here, but I wonder if you already talked a little bit about what people can do to help. Are there things that you'd like to emphasize that you haven't quite had a chance to do yet?
Just don't look away. I know that it can be really overwhelming to think about extinction and the climate crisis and endangered species, but it's so important that people who do care keep caring and take actions, no matter how small they are, so that they stay inspired, and also to find community so that we have each other and we know that across the country and across the world, other people are also pushing for protection of the environment, which, you know, the environment is completely related to justice and social justice.
Yes.
And environmental justice. And so all of the fights are intertwined, and we have to stay inspired and connected and keep fighting them.
Thank you so much. That's a really inspirational, actually, closing. I appreciate it very much. Tierra Curry is a senior scientist at the Center for Biological Diversity, where she leads the Saving Life on Earth campaign to end extinction. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us. I really appreciate it.
Of course, and good luck at your meeting. Go save that habitat.
Okay, thank you. Bye-bye.
Take care.
We want to remind you that Ecotopia is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by Lily's Brazilian Bistro, offering traditional Brazilian cuisine made from fresh, locally sourced organic ingredients in the heart of downtown Chico. Lily's Brazilian Bistro serves traditional Brazilian dishes as diverse, exciting, and colorful as Brazil itself. Located at 142 Broadway, they're open Monday through Saturday from 11 a.m. to 9 p.m. with dine-in and outdoor seating. More information, including to-go orders and reservations, at 530-399-0675 and on Facebook and Instagram. We're also made possible by Chico Performances. They're presenting Jazz at Lincoln Center, performing Songs We Love, a musical journey through the history of jazz from the 20s through the 50s. The world-renowned performers of jazz at Lincoln Center take the stage with three vocalists to celebrate the songs of the early jazz era made famous by Sinatra, Billie Holiday, Ella Fitzgerald, Judy Garland, and others. The concert is on January 24th in Lacson Auditorium. More information is available at chicoperformances.com. And you heard Susan talking again about the Valley's Edge project, about which she is passionate, and will remind you that the opinions expressed on Ecotopia do not necessarily represent the views or opinions of KZFR, its staff, board of directors, underwriters, or volunteers. The Chico City Council is meeting tonight. It is meeting as we speak. They started at 6 o'clock to consider the approval of the Valley's Edge Development Project. It's not too late for you to get yourself down to City Hall, City Council chambers to record your comments. The opponents of this project need both money and volunteers to stop urban sprawl project, which will lead to increasing traffic and congestion, increased greenhouse gas emissions, and addition of almost 3,000 houses that are definitely not affordable for the residents of Chico who need housing, and there is increased fire risk in the East Chico foothills and grassland. This development is touted as having open spaces, hiking trails, and parks. However, with the exception of one park operated by the underfunded CARD, the 1,446 acres of land will be open exclusively to HOA members. But they do say if you want to pay a fee, you can walk in their parks. If you are interested in donating for legal action or in volunteering to work to stop the project, give Susan an email, Susan Chudy, SusanTchud, at gmail.com. In addition, the Smart Growth Advocates Group will be holding a fundraiser concert with three local folk groups. This will be Sunday, January 8th, 4 to 7 p.m. at the Center for Spiritual Living. Tickets are $20. There'll be a silent auction. You can go to Eventbrite and save our hometown. With the beginning of the year, Reuters has issued an article on four Supreme Court cases to keep your eye on in the coming year. The 15-year fight between Northern Idaho landowners and Chantel and Michael Sackett and the U.S. and EPA made its way to the Supreme Court for a second time in October, and the court's decision could clarify what properties are subject to regulation under the landmark 1972 Clean Water Act. The Sacketts, represented by the conservative Pacific Legal Foundation, argue the law applies narrowly to lands with continuous surface connection to a major stream, lake, or river. The EPA argues that the law is broader, covers lands with a significant nexus to a waterway. The agency issued a final rule codifying that interpretation in December. A narrower test could result in as much as 51% of wetlands and 18% of streams across the country being excluded from protections, according to a 2017 U.S. Army Corps of Engineers estimate. If the court rules for the conservative Sacketts, it would be the most consequential decision under the Clean Water Act in its history, said Victor Flatt, an environmental law professor at the University of Houston. Another key Supreme Court case coming up is Held versus the State of Montana. Young people across the U.S. and the world have in recent years launched several lawsuits claiming governments are violating their constitutional and human rights through fossil fuel-friendly policies that exacerbate the climate crisis. Having trouble with words tonight. Held is the first of several in the U.S. to go to trial, which is currently scheduled for June. A group of 16 young people in that case claim Montana is violating its own constitution, which specifically guarantees a right to a clean and healthful environment by promoting fossil fuel industries such as coal. The suit was filed in 2020, takes aim at two state laws that encourage fossil fuel energy development in the state and bar environmental reviews from considering how a project such as a power plant will contribute to climate change. Our Children's Trust, the firm representing the Montana plaintiffs, also represents youth plaintiffs in court in Hawaii, Virginia, and Utah, as well as the flagship U.S. youth climate case, Juliana versus United States. And as several people have noted, this lawsuit by young people started when the kids were about 12 in 2012, so that means they're in their 20s by now, waiting a long time for satisfaction. A third lawsuit that will be crucial in the coming year, City and County of Honolulu versus Sun Oko LP. After years of jostling over whether climate suits against big oil belong in state or federal court, 2023 could see some movement in cases filed by states and municipalities against oil companies BP, Shell, Exxon, and others, alleging that companies knowingly contributed to the climate crisis and must help pay for the damages. The case to watch is City and County of Honolulu versus Sunoco LP et al., where the municipalities have made state claims for trespass, nuisance, negligence, and strict liability. Hawaii State Judge Jeffrey Crabtree has told the parties to begin limited discovery, meaning depositions and document subpoenas are likely in the coming year. The suit is the only case thus far out of more than 20 to reach that stage. I erred earlier, this is not a Supreme Court case. This is a Hawaii case. A pending appeal filed by the oil companies at the Supreme Court, was right in the first place, could have a significant impact on the proceedings in Hawaii. The oil companies in the nation's high court are hoping to upend a series of circuit court decisions saying the cases belong in state courts where they were filed. If the court takes the appeal and rules for the oil companies, then the cases would be moved to federal court, the preferred venue for industry defendants. An earlier similar case filed by New York City directly in federal court was tossed in 2021 by an appellate court after the judges determined the state law claims over global climate greenhouse gas emissions are preempted by federal law. There's also a case about PFAS litigation, a sprawling multi-district litigation lawsuit based in South Carolina over per- and polyfluoroalkyl substances, PFAS, contamination in public water systems is scheduled for its first bellwether trial in 2023. It'll start with the city of Stewart versus 3M in June. Bellwether trials are chosen as test cases and are used to work through common legal and factual issues. The suit is filed by the city of Stewart, Florida, against manufacturers of PFAS containing firefighting foams such as 3M Company, ChemGuard Inc., and Tyco Fire Products. The city's public water system has been contaminated with PFAS, which are also called forever chemicals, since they do not easily break down in nature or the human body. PFAS water contamination has spurred over 6,400 lawsuits since 2005, according to the law firm Thompson Colburn, including those in the South Carolina district and one filed by California Attorney General Rob Bonta in November. The suits claim the companies made products with PFAS for years, despite knowing the chemicals cause cancer, developmental defects, and other health issues. The medical monitoring and cleanup costs from PFAS in the environment and public water systems are likely to be staggering, according to the lawsuit filed by California. Companies have already agreed to pay more than $1 billion in settlements over contamination in previous cases. And in 2021, DuPont, Chemours, and Corteva reached an agreement to pay for future settlements for up to $4 billion. The companies have denied wrongdoing. 3M announced last month it was going to stop producing PFAS by 2025. Jane Conroy, a shareholder of law firm Simmons Hanley Conroy, said PFA's concerns are likely only to grow as the public becomes more aware of the problem. I think it will be a huge year for this issue, said Conroy of 2023. You've been listening to Ecotopia on KZFR. It's been a rainy couple of weeks, days in our area. We're going to close the show tonight with Bob Dylan's It's a Hard Rain. Thanks for listening.
Oh, where have you been, my blue-eyed son? And where have you been, my darling young one? I've stumbled on the side of 12 misty mountains. I've walked and I crawled on 6 crooked highways. I've stepped in the middle of 7 side forests. I've been out in front of a dozen dead oceans. I've been 10,000 miles in the mouth of a graveyard. And it's a hard, it's a hard, it's a hard, it's a hard, it's a hard rain that's gonna fall. Oh, what did you see, my blue-eyed son? And what did you see, my darling young one? I saw a newborn baby with wild wolves all around it. I saw a highway of diamonds with nobody on it. I saw a black branch with blood that kept dripping. A room full of men with their hammers a-bleeding. I saw a white ladder all covered with water. I saw 10,000 talkers whose tongues were all broken. I saw guns and sharp swords in the hands of young children. And it's a hard, it's a hard, it's a hard, and it's a hard rain that's gonna fall. Oh, what did you hear, my blue-eyed son? And what did you hear, my darling young one? Heard the sound of a thunder that roared out a warning. I heard the roar of a wave that could drown the whole world. I heard 100 drummers whose hands were ablazing. I heard 10,000 whispering and nobody listening. I heard one person starve, I heard many people laughing. I heard the song of a poet who died in the gutter. I heard the sound of a clown who cried in the alley. And it's a hard, it's a hard, it's a hard, it's a hard, it's a hard. Are gonna fall. Oh, what did you meet, my blue-eyed son? And who did you meet, my darling young one? I met a young child beside a dead pony. I met a white man who walked a black dog. I met a young woman whose body was burning. A young girl, she
Mixtape Give and Take is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by Butte College, where your future starts with three-week classes beginning January 3rd, are offered online at the Butte College main campus or the Chico Center. If you can't join this winter, spring classes include cosmetology and barbering at the main campus, Chico and Skyway Centers, and their new Glenn County Center in Orland. Promise scholarships are also